Welcome to episode 5 of the Eat the Evidence podcast, a show for cake and cookie decorators and sugar artists of all kinds. I'm your host, Kimberly Chapman, and on this episode, we are going to delve into new edible art territory with Jessica Lee Clark-Bogen of piesareawesome.com to talk about her amazing tricks on the forefront of pie decorating. I've also got my last two clips from the Austin Cake Show to share, with a story from Deborah Otten, plus some cake formations and a short chat with Heather Sherman of Art to Eat Cakes. So whether you're up to your elbows in fondant trying to get your cakes covered, hunched over cookies with a needle tool to make those perfect edges, or chilling out after a big project's done and out the door, let's get this show started to inspire you to all kinds of new sweet delights. Hey guys, episode 5 and still alive, coming to you from my bright and sunny and noticeably not air-conditioned kitchen here in Cambridge in the UK. We here in England are just hitting that point of the year where any day could be cold enough for a sweater or hot enough that nothing productive will get done with chocolate, which makes planning ahead super tricky. I've done cakes in Las Vegas, Nevada, and Austin, Texas, and now here in Cambridge, so I've really seen how much local weather can make a huge difference in what cakes you can make and how you have to work it all out and transport it and all of that. I learned the hard way that a ganached cake with modeling chocolate panels is pretty risky at an outside venue in Austin, even in late October. I've had fondant dry hard before I could even finish sculpting a face in Las Vegas. And I've had fondant melt off a buttercreamed base here in Cambridge from a sudden massive shift in humidity. So while it might seem mundane to some folks to talk about the weather, those of us in the edible art industry know that weather can make the difference of whether or not things set up or stick together or not, or get super sticky or run off the cake or so many other issues. And that's part of what you get good at with practice as a serious artist in this business, and one of the challenges we face in talking to potential clients, who don't have it in their minds about how much weather and the nature of the venue can affect the outcome. They might know to consider that some fillings need to be kept chilled for health reasons, but most of them aren't going to know about gum paste and humidity, or modeling chocolate sweating out its fat. So for those of you all over the world, in all kinds of climates, a big shout out for the expertise you bring to the table about your local environment and all of the challenges you face with that. Clients may not always get it, but your friends in the industry do. In this episode, I'm using up the last of my clips from the Austin Show back in February, so I'm really, really hoping more of you will call in to share your tips, tricks, and stories both triumphant and terrifying about the challenges you face from weather to clients to anything else you've got going on. It's easy and free to drop me a voicemail on Messenger and Facebook anytime, day or night. Think of it as free therapy to vent out your sugar arts frustrations on an understanding audience. Meanwhile, I've got a really cool interview for you today that gets around a lot of these cakey problems with the weather by skipping the cake part altogether and going in for pies. That's right, artistic pies. In the middle of the interview, I sort of off the cuff decided to put out an informal challenge, and since I did the interview a couple of weeks ago, it seemed reasonable to set the deadline as the end of June. But now it's already mid-June, so I want to give you guys a bit more time than that. So don't panic at the deadline in the interview ahead. Stay tuned, and at the end, I'll give some more details on how to join in the fun, and we'll extend the deadline to a month from the release date of this episode. So relax and enjoy the exciting new world of decorative pie art. I'm joined now by Jessica Lee Clark-Bogen of piesareawesome.com in Vancouver, British Columbia. Many of you may have seen some of her viral video hits of her amazing 3D pie crusts featuring Rocket and Baby Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy. That's where I first saw you. And other amazing and deliciously nerdy works of edible art. She's got an ebook coming out on June 5th on Amazon called Pie Modding. And I'm so glad she's here to talk to us about all of her incredible projects. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
I've been trolling through your your Instagram, and which I will link in show notes. I'll make sure everyone has links to all of your social media stuff, because your stuff is just amazing. I mean, partly because I'm a nerd, and so I love that you did your Tesla pie. Oh my God. I saw Tesla. That was so great. But where did you come up with doing these things?
It started very randomly. My background is as a filmmaker and designer. And in 2015, totally out of the blue, I decided to have a New Year's resolution where I wouldn't eat any sugar at all for 1 year. And for those that know me, they know I really, really like sugar. So this was very hard for me. And out of desperation, I decided I better learn how to bake pies, because pies were sort of the only dessert that you could not have sugar in and still have it, you know, not taste like butt. So I went to the internet for inspiration and guidance on baking pies. And you know, I like to learn new things and infuse geeky flavor into whatever I make. And I was really surprised. I found all these amazing nerdy cakes and cupcakes and cookies and even waffles and breads and things like that. But there weren't really any unusual pies out there. They were all fairly, you know, garden variety. And I thought that was a bit strange, but I started making my own twists on things. I had spoken with some of my baker friends and I asked them, you know, what gives? Like, why are people creating these, you know, incredible epic cakes, and yet when you look at pies, there's not really anything out there? And they told me that pie has two problems. The first problem is that you've got a ticking clock. The dough starts to dry out and crack if you work with it too long. And then the second problem is the unpredictability in the oven. Dough has a habit of puffing up and obliterating any details that you put a lot of effort into. And those are sort of the two big stumbling blocks that were preventing people from really experimenting with more sort of figurative pies. And I kind of took that as a thrown gauntlet. Like, I am going to crack this nut. So long story short, I spent the next year doing all different kinds of, you know, chemistry experiments and sculptural experiments to figure out how I could make pies more interesting and still taste good. And that's kind of how I got to where I am today. People responded surprisingly well to the stuff that I was putting out there. And I decided to keep going with this and make more of it and see how far I can take this.
Well, that's definitely, I mean, by the time this episode comes out, your book will have been out. I've just put it in pre-order, because when I saw your stuff, I saw you going up. I've tried to make nerdy cakes flat. I have the pie-shaped pie pan that had a Kickstarter a few years ago, and we do pie in this household. When I saw your Kickstarter had the stretch goal for the $31,415, I just laughed so hard because I knew exactly what you were doing. I have a kid who memorized pi at the same time she's learning the alphabet, so it's really a thing in our house. So I've put pi in pies, but yeah, every time I tried to do something artsy in pie, I came up against the puffing, and so I gave up. So I'm definitely curious to see your book to see how you get around some of this stuff. And I've been watching your videos and see how you pre-bake the things, and I wonder, is that part of how you're getting around that?
There's a bunch of different little techniques that all of which I share in my book. I'm very open about sharing all my secrets because I want there to be more awesome pies out there in the universe. And the two big things that I discovered was using tools like the template stencils that I make and things like that to help speed things up, but also cold. So one of the reasons why pie puffs up and the shapes tend to obliterate in the oven is, I won't get into the chemistry of melting gluten and stuff like that, but chemical reactions are happening more quickly than you want them to. So if you do something very detailed and intricate, if you put it in the freezer for 10 minutes and then immediately bake it, you won't lose your detail. And then there's some other little tricks like doing a vanilla wash or vanilla and brown food coloring wash on any carvings that you do. It goes into the little cracks, and as it bakes, those cracks become dark lines. So even if the dough puffs up a little bit, you've got these nice, sharp, little crisp lines that stay and show off your detail. So that's how I'm able to do the more sort of sculptural things like the baby Groot and stuff like that, and not lose all the little fine lines when it bakes.
Yeah, I was, again, watching through the videos and just watching you painting on. I'm like, I have these colors. I should do this. This looks like a thing I should do. I have a heating core. I'm going to, again, link in the show notes to the thing. But when I saw you using the heating core for big cakes to wrap the thing around for Groot, I'm like, she's a genius. Oh, my God. And I like just started immediately, but a few weeks ago, before I'd first contacted you, just started following you like slavishly everywhere going, oh, I love this.
But, well, yeah, I'm a big fan of using things that are not meant for pie in pie. I fail a lot.
Oh, but that's okay.
Not. one of my big fails was, as you know, pie dough shrinks when it bakes. And figuring out how much it's going to shrink and getting a sense for, you know, that kind of thing, that was a big learning curve for me at first. So using the heating core, for example, I know this is going to shrink. And I know that if I don't plan for the shrinkage, it's going to crack. So I had to make sure that I didn't have it too tightly stuck on there when I put it in the oven. Mm-hmm. So that when it shrunk about 5 millimeters or so, it's still going to, it's going to be a perfect fit after. So there's a whole bunch of little things that I'm doing that I don't necessarily spell out in the videos. Like, you know, make sure you make this covering 0.5 of a centimeter bigger than, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I want to start getting into videos with talking so that I can actually tell people all those little things that I'm doing as I go along.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think some of them or some of your Instagram had said pointed to a blog, but I couldn't find the blog. I think have you moved it off the site?
Well, I'm using when I first started piesareawesome.com. I wasn't doing video yet. They were just weekly sort of blog posts where I'd have pictures and text. And then I got some advice from some people who had, you know, food YouTube channels saying you gotta start doing video. That's the only way that you're gonna get people to notice you and publications to pick you up. So once I started doing the videos, the writing side of it kind of dropped off a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because it's a lot of work to sort of maintain both. And then I started working on the copy for the book, and that took up a bit of my time. But yeah, I'd like to be able to have a bit more in-depth tutorial information.
Yeah, I want it. I can tell you right now. Because yeah, it looks, I mean, just the looks of the stuff that you're getting is amazing. And when I've been watching and seeing, I see you waggle a bottle a lot labeled sugar glue. I'm like, okay, what's in her sugar glue? I think in one of your posts, you called it fondant glue. Is that same thing then?
It's Michael's brand, or not Michael's brand. It's Wilton brand from Michael's. I think it's called, what is it called? Sugar something. It's basically just, you know, sticky glycerin.
Okay,
that's so used to paste. You can make your own quite easily.
Yeah, that's why I wasn't sure if you had made your own or if, because it was just labeled sugar glue on the bottle.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrapped all of my things in the blog because I don't have the rights to show the Wilton labels or logos. But that, the sugar glue and egg wash or egg whites as a glue for anything that's getting baked, mm-hmm. those are two of my really big staples for putting together these more elaborate compositions.
Yeah, they are elaborate. I mean, we're going to be blowing so many minds, particularly when the cake artist people see this. I predict you might be setting off a huge trend here because I know I'm involved with the Austin Cake Show, and I'm already going to be poking people there to say, maybe we should have a pies competition. I mean, there's been talk of, we've gotten more cookies and stuff. You know, particularly the cookie trend has been building for years, and it took some work getting that into the cake show because at first the cookie people didn't want to come. But yeah, I could foresee pies being the next big thing that we're all competing with at these shows, and you're at the forefront of it.
That would be awesome.
And I noticed it said that this the one that's coming out, Pie Modding, is the first in a series of mini books. So what else have you got planned?
I want to produce more, like you mentioned, pies, you know, tend to take a backseat to cakes and cookies and other things at events like weddings and even, you know, just family celebrations because of their low profile. The next topic that I want to tackle is the pie scrapers. So teaching people how to get stability in vertical pies. So not just simply getting three flat pies and putting them on a dessert stand, but how do you actually make it like a wedding cake? Because, you know, multi-tiered cakes aren't just a bunch of dough plunked on top of each other. They over the years painstakingly figured out you've got to have supports in there, and you've got to have, you know, cake boards, and you need to use a denser cake if you're going to put fondant on it, and all these little tips and tricks that have been developed over the years. I want to do the same thing with pies now.
That is so awesome. I'm just going to squee a little bit because that is so cool, and that you're experimenting with this. And yeah, because you will have the failures like you mentioned, but my gig is I don't really sell cakes. I call myself an experimental cake decorator, and I embrace that sort of Mythbusters thing of failure is always an option because failure is good data.
Absolutely.
It doesn't mean it's not frustrating to fail, especially if there's you feel like there's wasted food, and I'm doing air quotes around it, wasted food. But then to some extent, when we're doing these things, if you think of it as a medium for artistry, then it feels less like waste, especially when it is sugar and you probably shouldn't be sticking it in your face anyway.
Yeah. My worst series of fails, usually things, I'll post them even if something didn't work out the way I wanted it to, because other people can learn from my mistakes. But the worst frustrating one for me was I was doing a pie for the Food Network's channel that was a Beauty and the Beast stained glass lemon pie. And I had to make that thing 6 times while I had a horrible sinus infection. And I could barely think, which probably contributed to my repeated failures. Because I wasn't sure exactly what medium was the right to use to make the edible stained glass effect, and the little bars around it kept bleeding into the stained glass, and I was like, oh, so frustrating. And every time, you know, I try something and it doesn't work out, I have to make the base pie again. Mm-hmm. So eventually I hit upon something that worked perfectly, and I was so happy to finally be finished this. And as I'm pulling it out of the oven, I accidentally touched my hand against the door and burned it. Mm-hmm. And this must have been very comical to watch. The pie went up in the air as I screamed and splattered all over the whole kitchen. So I was like, and it was due the next morning. So I was just like, that's fine. It's okay. It's, you know, I'm just going to start again. Everything's good. Everything's fine.
Oh, God, you're more mature than I am.
So I stayed up till 4 a.m. I made it again, edited the video, got it in. Everything was fine. It looked great. But yeah, that one was a little bit pushing my patience. But
I bet. Oh, I definitely want to talk to you about translucency and stuff. I've got a little ebook on my site called Flexible Edible Stained Glass. Now you can't cook it because it's gelatin based. So this is the whole thing is what you're using the temperature to set it up. So if you heat it, I mean, like, because obviously you want to go hotter than you're looking at candies and stuff, unless you're doing something else, which I definitely want to know about. But yeah, I'm thinking of, oh, how could I incorporate the gelatin stained glass? It's basically jello based, with extra gelatin, and it's self-fusing. So you can make these big flexible bendy panels, which is great to wrap around a cake. But if you're trying to stand it up as part of a pie crust, wouldn't necessarily work. And you definitely couldn't put it on top of a liquid pie center. So, okay, so I'm just going to flat out ask, are you just using candy in the pie crust?
Well, one of my pet peeves is edible food that's not actually really edible. You know, you'll see a lot of people make very elaborate cake toppers and designs and things like that are technically, you know, made out of food. Even though I love playing around with sugar and isomalt and making that, you know, really fancy sculptural things, my husband wanted to actually eat this pie. And he doesn't like the big, you know, sort of lollipop texture things sitting on top of his pies because you have to take it off and throw away, which that's a lot of work.
Right.
But what I did for my stained glass was agar mixture that I piped on with a pipette at the very, very end. I made, for the wrought iron trim, I made very, very thin dough partway through the baking cycle. And then I was able to carefully paint those black, put it back in the oven for 10 minutes to bake the lines. And then when they came out and cooled completely, then I could pipe in the different colors of agar gel, put the whole thing in the fridge for 10 minutes to have it set up. And that worked out really well.
Okay, cool. Yeah, because I saw your Tron video with the tonic water and the agar.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that is actually similar to what I'm doing, although I'm letting mine dry. Mike McCary called it edible PVC.
That's cool.
So, and it is, I mean, it tastes like jello, whatever jello you put into it, unless you use completely unflavored, and then it sort of tastes like nasty gelatin, unless you put some flavoring in it. But yeah, because I'm the same thing that I recognize the artistry reasons why we do some things in cake that are in that technically edible space. But this is kind of why I don't do flowers, because I'm kind of offended by wire. And I understand, and I'm not knocking flowers. I know they are. I have to be careful here because I know this is a major part of the industry. But it's why I don't do them, because I don't want to work with wire unless I'm doing beading. If I'm doing, you know, if I'm doing a different craft, then I'll work with wire. Yeah. When I'm working with food, I want to work with food. So I've been experimenting with pasta, you know, vermicelli, and making, I made some pasta plants on a thing I did for a competition last year. And then the judges hated it because it wasn't alive, like how you can bend wire. And I'm like, yeah, but it's 100% edible. And they're like, yeah, that's not what we're looking for.
Yeah. It's a fine line, and that I'm running into the same things with the pie scraper designs as well. Like, how much do you sacrifice the aesthetics to make something that's more pure, I guess, air quotes, pure, when it comes to the edible side of things? I sort of see it as a challenge to try to make things as edible as possible. But I know that, you know, at a certain point, one of the pies that I made that was a Legend of Zelda Deku tree pie, that was the first time I'd ever put something that wasn't edible into the pie. I made a wire armature to hold up some little tarts around, whereas the previous pie scraper I'd done was only edible food elements. So there's pros and cons, and mm-hmm. I'm sort of feeling my way through that right now.
Yeah, I saw that video too, and because I was watching it, at first I looked at it, I'm like, that cannot be standing that tall as just crust, unless it was like, I don't know, you know, breadstick hard crust. I mean, just another thing, like, you can use breadsticks to hold things up, but then, honestly, with breadsticks, I know we give them to our kids, but this is really challenging edibility for me on a personal level, that those nasty, crunchy, hard breadsticks start to be, ooh. But yeah, when I saw the wire frame, I'm like, well, that makes total sense. And you incorporated it really well. So the end result didn't look like a wire armature. It looked like crust.
Yeah. I want to make sure, even if I am incorporating something that's not food, I want to make sure that it's very easy to work around. So it's not, you know, taking up the whole bottom of your pie, or, you know, essentially making it not really a pie anymore. And that was a pretty easy thing to take out and eat around. The big giant dough pieces, that was another sort of learning challenge, is figuring out how to make, I call them standees, how to make dough standees in pie that won't fall over, and how high can you go before it does want to fall over. And the big secret, which I also talk about in my book, to making those things work, because at first I was like, maybe I need thicker dough or whatever. It's not about the thickness of the dough. It's about sandwiching a agent in between two layers of dough. I use egg that's going to be waterproof.
Right.
So when you take two layers of dough and put a generous helping of egg wash in between them and then bake that, it's super sturdy. And it's still nice and light and flaky like normal pie crust.
Right. Well, you're basically putting a protein infrastructure.
Yes.
Yeah. I think about these things far too often. I lay in bed at night thinking, how could I manipulate proteins in my kitchen that is not a laboratory to make wire-free flours? I seriously think about this way too often, because I keep thinking, well, what if I made my own pasta that had extra egg in it? But what's, you know, because you need, you know, tensile strength versus shearing strength, and now it's physics, and I don't have a degree in that.
But it is, it like the mechanical engineering and physics, and it's all part of this, and you know, master cake decorators like yourself, these are the things that you deal with, and where you get ideas for new ways of you know, I'm sure there is a way to make edible wire that feels alive but is still food based, like maybe it's making your own pasta but drying it in a particular shape or something like that.
Yeah, that's definitely what I've been pondering and thinking. I've seen other people, I've used the vermicelli a few times for like tiny little bucket handles, or I braided vermicelli once for braids on a Jack and Jill cupcake. That was, yeah, braiding vermicelli is not fun because the longer it sits, the more the starches are coming out and the more it wants to stick to everything and not move around. And you have that very narrow window of when you've softened it before it's going to harden up again. And once you've hardened it, you know, when you take raw pasta, it's stronger than pasta that's been cooked and then dried. Because you're changing the proteins inside there, and so it becomes much more brittle on the other side of that structure. And then, yeah, like you were talking about with shrinkage, you have to... I made so many bucket handles for one bucket for the Jack and Jill piece because of how many times the arc just shrunk beyond the fondant or the gum paste bucket that I'd made. Hmm. So, yeah, I completely know what you mean about trying to... experiment this stuff through, but I'm so excited to see what you're gonna keep coming up with and what other people are coming up with. I saw that with your Kickstarter. I wish I'd known about that because I would have been so on board with that. can people the pie guides? Could you talk a bit about those and can people order them separately now or what's going on with that?
They're all sitting in a giant box in my living room right now, so I'm going to be trying to, very patient family. I'm going to be trying to get them into the storefront soon, but I have to ship to the backers first. So that's being packaged for them right now. Pie guides are flexible, food-safe stencils that you can use to very quickly cut out different shapes that you can, either as negatives or positives in pie dough, that you can put together and create different sort of nerdy compositions. And I designed them so that they can be used with store-bought pie crust. So if you've just got access to, you know, a tender flake double crust pie or something like that, you can place these stencils on top. And the way that the elements interlock, you can still create interesting combinations, even if you don't have extra dough to play around with.
That is very cool. I was just looking at them going, there's no reason they couldn't be used with gum paste.
Oh, totally.
I mean, it's a really, literally and figuratively, flexible product that could definitely be used, particularly because I teach a lot of beginners who are afraid and think they can't. So even though an expert could probably make their, and particularly for custom cakes on the high competition end, people are going to design their own template or whatever. But on that end where we're trying to get people to just do it because it's fun. I mean, I loved your Kickstarter video where it showed you in the corner as the people presented to the gaming table their awesome pie and they all went, oh, that was amazing. I love that. I'm going to link to it. Even though the Kickstarter is over, I'm going to link to it so people can see your adorable video. It's so great. I seriously have just been fangirling at you for the last couple of days and you didn't even know it. Even aside from when I found your stuff, I'm like, I should prepare for this interview. And I'm like, oh, look at her. And now she's got tonic water. And now she's got this. Oh. It's just, I've been squeeing so much. But yeah, so as soon as you know when those are available, let me know. And aside from the podcast, I'm happy to just share it because I know people who'd be into it in various countries. But I was so glad to see your Kickstarter did so well. You exceeded the pie times 10,000.
Yeah, yay.
Congratulations, that's huge.
Yeah, that was a big surprise. I thought that I would reach my goal because I had talked to friends and family and they all seemed to think that it was a good idea. But I had no idea that it would take off the way that it did and so quickly. So that definitely gave me encouragement to get going with my book and keep trying new experiments.
Well, I think you've hit a really good balance here of you doing the amazing 3D sculptures, which are going to be highly intimidating to a beginner, but they get the viral, I mean, that's again how I found you. They get the viral sharing, but then now you're presenting them with, but you don't have to do the big scary thing that you don't know how to do because here is a template and a reasonably priced ebook. Because, you know, I buy cake books and stuff on occasion, but, you know, no one pays me very much, you know, the time. So I'm not buying $20, $30 books. So putting it out as an ebook and having that stuff, it's really good because it's easy for entry-level people to do something fun while also still worshiping your high art end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, I'm not close-fisted about my techniques at all. My goal is to see crazy, awesome, amazing pies that I could never have thought of all over the place. That would make me very, very happy. So with things like my pie modding book, I wanted to make every single pie in that book, which I know some people might get slightly ticked off about, but every single pie in that book is a store-bought base pie. So I just went out to the local Safeway and bought whatever they had on the shelf. And then I show how easy it is using prefab rollout, you know, Pillsbury dough, whatever, to create these really cool compositions. That's not to say that if you make your own dough from scratch, it's not going to be better. It will absolutely be better, and it'll probably taste a heck of a lot better than a store-bought pie. But I want to go after the, like, you know, gamers and comic book nerds and other people who like pie but don't necessarily consider themselves bakers or find something about the whole process intimidating, and go like, look, you don't even have to know how to bake the pie. You can still just go to the store and buy this and slap these two things together, and it will look like nothing your friends have ever seen before. And I'm hoping that that will encourage the novices and the master bakers to go, holy crap, if they can do that with a crappy store-bought pie and crappy rollout dough, think what I can do knowing how to actually make a real pie and real pie dough.
Oh, totally. And, you know, one of the things, the benefits of you having done it with the store-bought dough, I mean, because I know how to make crust, which is why I buy store-bought dough, because I have small children. And, you know, it's why I also have learned the joy of frozen mashed potatoes that not the powder stuff that's got, because I know what silicon dioxide is. So when I read the powdered stuff, I'm like, ew, that's sand. Gross. But, you know, frozen mashed potatoes, that's got potato, water, and salt. I can mash potatoes. Yeah. But I have small children, and if I don't have to mash potatoes, now I can have a roast chicken dinner. Well, with pie, I can make pie crust. But, you know, you really got to let it hydrate for a couple of hours. If I just have the pie crusts in my freezer, I can go, you know what, guys? We're having pie tonight.
Exactly.
And I can just do that. We have apple trees in our backyard here in England, and I still miss my Macintosh from growing up in Ontario. But the ones here are close enough to the Macintosh. And so, when the season hits, I can just have a freezer full of dough. And which I'm telling you right now, there are going to be some epic pies coming out this autumn. My littlest one starts full-time kindergarten, and I'm going to have apples, and I'm going to have a freezer full of dough, and I'm going to make some fancy pies. I promise you that.
Awesome.
In fact, I'm thinking, I should continue the other thought, that with the store-bought dough, because one of the things I've learned moving from Canada to the U.S. to England is different places have different protein in the flour and different water in the butter.
Hmm.
And so a cookie recipe, I mean, Canada and U.S. is kind of the same if you're using the big national brands. If you're using like Robin Hood flour or King Arthur flour or Gold Medal, any of those big brands, they're pretty consistent. But even like your food books will tell you that, or Alton Brown or whoever will tell you that if you use like store brand flour in Louisiana, that is different flour than what you would get in Alberta. In terms of protein and hardness. And it turns out British flour is super, super soft. So, like, they don't even sell cake flour here because they don't need to. Whereas if I want a cookie that's not going to spread, I use what they call strong flour here, which is kind of like bread flour. But if you want really strong flour, you know what they sell here? Canadian hard flour. Which I'm like patriotic Canadian and everything, but I'm still not going to buy the Canadian hard flour because of the high carbon footprint, because that's just kind of pushing it for me. But learning about this and learning that British butter has more, I think it's that British butter has more fat and American butter has more water. And so the spread for something as simple as a sugar cookie, whereas if you're trying to do, I've been trying to get into 3D cookies and stuff, and the spread is different using the exact same, even by weight, ingredients versus, you know, North America versus England. When you put it in these, the store-bought pastry crusts, even if it's a different brand, they're going to have a consistency across brands that's more likely because they're all trying to get to a same result in terms of spread and puff and whatever. So I bet you that the Tesco dough that I buy is probably similar to your Tenderflake dough or Pillsbury in the States than if we each just went out and bought raw ingredients and made dough.
Yeah, probably. I had no idea there was that. I mean, it makes sense, but I guess you must have done a bit of trial and error when you started making cookies in the UK.
I had some failures. I had some like, wait, why is this? I mean, I have my own favorite chocolate rolled cookie dough that I had perfected and put on my blog in the States, and because it didn't spread. It had a little bit of leavener in it, but not very much, like enough so that it wasn't too, you know, toothy. But it was really good, and I could do, you know, a shaped cutout, and there was very little spread. And then I brought it here, and I'm like, why do I have a puddle? So I had to tweak it. And yeah, like I said, removing all the leavener. So it is actually a harder it's more like a British biscuit now, and putting in the stronger flour, it seemed to be the keys. So yeah, I will definitely be trying with the Tesco dough because that's the cheap dough I buy. And it's good. You know, it's good. It passes. It's not Alton Brown fancy, tender, flaky with puppets that punch you. I don't know if you've seen that. That's one of my favorite Alton Brown things ever, is when he talks about tender versus flaky and how they're not opposed, but he talks about the science of rolling the butter into the pockets that are creating steam and lift in your pie crust. Yeah, all that good stuff, right? I know the science. That's why I'm buying the crust, because I respect how difficult it can be.
Exactly. When I first started making stuff, I started by scratch because I needed to know what the ingredients were. And I was like, oh my God, this is time consuming. What? I can't believe people do this. And then I learned more. I'm like, oh, I can just buy this at the store. Okay.
That's right. Yeah.
If I'm doing a pie for a friend or for like a family event or something like that, then I'll take the time to actually make it by hand and, you know, be a lot more concerned about getting the bottom perfectly unsoggy and all that kind of stuff. But if it's just stuff that I'm making to, you know, experiment with a new technique or whatever, it's like, yeah.
Yeah. That's when I use my cheap fondant, is I got an experiment or expired fondant. At the cake shows, we would often go home with all these opened buckets because now they can't sell them. They've been donated. And, you know, I don't use a lot of pink, so I would end up with pink fondant in the house. Okay, but now I want to try an experiment to see what happens if I don't know, light it on fire. No, don't light it on fire. It smells terrible. But been there, done that. But, you know, I would use that up. And so it's past its date. Who cares? No one's eating it. So there are ways that we in this can sort of mitigate the food waste as it is. Although, again, no one should eat fondant anyway.
Thank you. I know that's a touchy subject for some people, so I didn't want to bring it up. But I don't like eating fondant. I know that, like, you know, I like to sculpt with, you know, clay and polymer and stuff like that. So I appreciate what you can do with it, but it's, I don't know.
I don't know very many cake decorators who like the taste of fondant. There are good fondants and abysmal nasty fondants.
Yes.
And sometimes the nasty tasting fondant has the better properties for what you want to do structurally, because some of them never set up because you want it to drape. Or if you do figures like I do, you want it to set up like hard as a rock. And so, you know, fondant wars is a whole different, I'm sure I could do a whole episode. I could get like, make it like a terrible cable news channel. I could get a pro fondant of this kind and a pro fondant of that, and wind them up and let them yell at each other for an hour. We're never doing that episode, guys. We're never doing that episode. but yeah, I mean, that's part of why there's, you know, a constant buttercream resurgence of, well, look, you can do these effects in buttercream, but, you know, that's not always stable. I mean, I lived in Texas. Fondant holds the cake together.
Yeah.
Buttercream goes melty. So, you know, it's what you do what you need to.
Yeah, totally.
So are you doing anything particular to your filling, or could people use any filling they want?
Absolutely any filling you want. I try to make things so that they're very modular. You can put anything you want inside of it. The one caution is if you're doing handmade fruit fillings to bake it first, if you're putting in, you know, raw apples into your pie or other raw fruit ingredients, it's going to be a little less predictable in terms of what it's going to do to the crust.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've already boiled it, reduced it, made it, it's stable, and then use that as your filling, you're going to have a much more even top. And then I always make sure if I'm doing like a cherry or something very bubbly, that I keep an eye on it for the last couple minutes. And the first bubble I see, I immediately take it out. And even if it still needs a bit more time, I'll take it out, let the bubble set, and then put it back in, because I don't want it exploding all over my designs. Unless I've designed it in such a way that it can explode all over the place, which is okay too. Sometimes I add decorations after the base pie is cooked.
Now I'm thinking Halloween cakes with exploding cherry things everywhere, because I'm the kind of cake blogger who uses Dexter as a verb.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and not always child friendly, but I generally put warning. But you know what? Like, the number one hit on my blog consistently is the edible fake blood that tastes like Hershey's syrup, because that's what's in it. Now I'm just thinking of Alien popping out with boiling, exploding cherries everywhere. That would really be actually kind of awesome.
Totally.
Yeah, that needs to be a thing.
Yep.
Someone go make that. In fact, maybe we should issue a challenge. I don't have tons of listeners yet. I have about like 100, 150. But maybe I should issue some kind of challenge to go out in the next, I don't know, we can't make it this week because you can't make it a week. People are on deadline. But let's say give them to the end of June, guys. Let's say by the end of June, make a funky pie. And we'll feature them on the Facebook and the blog. And I don't think there's a prize for this. I think the prize is the notoriety of awesome Lord. Jessica seeing your awesome work. How about that? That is the amazing prize that you will get. And we will look at them and share them around. Go do it, guys. Just go, you know, on a down day, on your Monday when you're not on deadline, since that's when cake decorators tend to have their off day. Go make yourself a weird pie.
Yeah.
And get her book. We will definitely have a link to that. And in fact, yeah, like I said, I'll have read it by the time this comes out. I will squee about that further and not give it secrets away so people will come and buy it. Because it's only $3.99 US, guys, so that's totally reasonable. And so, yeah, we'll say end of June, make a weird pie, and impress Jessica. Or what kind of, not rules per se, but what challenge would you like to add to that?
Something you've never done before to a pie. Any technique, maybe you've tried it on a cake before, or maybe you've tried it in your wood shop before, or anywhere else in life. Because that's where I get most of my ideas from, just some random thing. I'm like, wow, your hat's really cool. I bet I can make a pie like that hat.
I've gone through so much of my life on various crafts, and my husband's like, you're beating that flower in your head right now, aren't you? You're making a cake of that cat right now, aren't you? I'm like, yeah. And then I cross over the craft, so like I've made rug hooking in buttercream.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, that is a good challenge. Do a thing you haven't done on a pie before. Do it by the end of June. I'll make maybe I should make a group or something for the podcast, or at least upload it on Facebook or Instagram. Find a way to tell us that it's somewhere, and we will share it around.
Cool.
Okay, very cool. Well, thank you very much for coming on. And I am so excited about the book. I'm so excited about your projects. I am definitely a squeeing fangirl.
That's awesome. I had a blast talking to you. It's great talking to people who understand, you know, the chemistry and think about the properties of the different ingredients they're using, too. It's cool.
Well, thank you so much. And definitely we should do this again whenever you've got anything else new coming out. Because, I want to collaborate or something going on into the future.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm going to extend that challenge deadline until 1 month from the release date of this episode, which is June 15th. So you have until July 15th, 2017, to participate. I've just set up a Facebook community for the podcast, which you can find by searching for Eat the Evidence Community in Facebook, and it's linked from the show's Facebook page under groups in the sidebar, and there'll be a link in the show notes and on the website as well. I'll make a pinned post for the duration of the challenge, and you can all post your funky pies in there as a sort of collection point, or if you want, you can just post on your own social media and tag me in so I see, and I can share that to the group for you. Super flexible, whatever works for you. Like I said, there's no particular winner or prize for this challenge. It's just for you to push yourself to try something fun and new and share it and be applauded for doing that. After the deadline, I'll see how many participants we got and talk about some of the best ones on the podcast and in a blog post too. So you can keep sharing your pies after the deadline as well, if you like, but the deadline gives us all a goal and a point where I can wrap it up and talk about the results. So get on out there and play with pie, you guys! And as also mentioned in the interview, when I talked to Jessica, her book hadn't come out yet. I had it on pre-order, but I hadn't seen it yet. Well, now I got my pre-order and I've had a look at it. I haven't read every direction all the way clearly through because, you know, let's be honest, whenever we get a cake book or anything, we flip through, we look at the pretty pictures, we sort of think, I'm going to do that technique and I'm going to try that. Oh, and here's a project that I want to do from start to finish and all that kind of thing. But having a skim over it, just as we talked about in the interview, it's really good at hitting that point where it's super beginner friendly because, yeah, all you need to do is go out and buy a pie someone else made and buy a crust that you can unroll and cut and play with. And just really just play. So it's a great opportunity to just play with your food in a low stress way. And of course, if you want to make your whole pie, then you can do that. You don't even need to do crust work if you don't want to. She's got a great, really funny pie in there that's a Cthulhu strawberry pie. So all she's done is taking like a strawberry pie that's pre-bought and some strawberries, and she's got like a template in there on how to cut some strawberries to make like a cute little octopus Cthulhu thing on the top. Anyway, so my 11-year-old is probably going to be all over that. It's not like she's read any Cthulhu books, but we're nerds, so we're always making Cthulhu references in the house. So it's super cute, and it's really good instruction level, really welcoming for beginners, but full of ideas for those of us who have done cake and cookie work to then take those skills to this other sort of adjacent medium of pies. So definitely get in there, have a look at the book. It's only $3.99 US. It's £3 and something on Amazon UK. And again, disclosure, I paid for it myself. Jessica did not give me a free book in exchange for a review or anything like that. I genuinely think she's awesome. I genuinely love this little book. I look forward to her work in the future. And I'm super excited about pies now, guys. Ever feel like the universe is conspiring against you to make everything go wrong in your kitchen? We've all been there. My friend Devra Otten shared this story with me back at the Austin Show in February in the hopes that it will amuse and inspire you to get through your next infuriating baking day.
Hey, this is Devra. Okay, so balls to the wall baking yesterday, trying to get ready, make three different things, get everything ready to go. And I was making some cookies that had Brazil nuts. So I had a Pyrex dish full of Brazil nuts sitting on the counter when my cat decided, first off, he's a cat, but he's entirely graceless. So he decided he would jump up on the counter, and he didn't entirely succeed. Instead, his feet just hit the edge of the Pyrex dish, flipped it, sent it flying, where it landed in the middle of my kitchen and shattered into a million pieces of Pyrex and Brazil nuts all over my floor, which also meant I had to start over on roasting the Brazil nuts a second time, after I picked glass out of every corner of my kitchen. But it was okay. I got it all done. It worked out. And I didn't kill him.
Now, some words of encouragement and some about delicious, delicious bacon from the lady I like to call my cake wife, because she's a super awesome, nerdy, hippie, amazing artist made out of love and joy and so much sugar. The one and only Heather Sherman speaking to me after the Austin Show in the hotel parking lot, because that was the first time we had for a quiet chat the whole weekend.
It is a beautiful Texas morning. Takes me back to my youth. I am Heather Sherman of Art to Eat Cakes. And here's my deal. Here's what I'm going to challenge you, all you cakers, to do, okay? This is our mission in caking. And I have to remind myself of this, that what we are doing is not a cake. What we are doing is performance art. And in fact, that is how we have to sell it and remind our clients to sell it all the time. And let me just elucidate a little bit. When your client orders a cake and you make it and they bring it to their venue, the first things that their guests see is they see this beautiful cake and they go, oh, right? And they all take pictures with it. And if you're corporate, they post it on social media with your hashtags and everybody enjoys it. And they're impressed and it ups the excitement of the event to start with. But then comes the gathering by the host and the refocusing of the attention, because now it's time for a cutting. and you pull out your giant sword knife and you cut the head off the beast, or you cut that cake apart. And this is indeed performance art. I never fail to get oohs and ahs and right? And people just love to see that there is indeed cake inside your creation. That's phase two. Again, more pictures, more excitement, more oohs and ahs, but then they get to taste it. And this is where our art is unique, in that they've already done the first parts, which is traditional art and performance art. And now we're going to have a flavor profile, which in of itself is a sensory experience, because people don't realize that your taste and your smell, those the olfactory bulb memories, are actually the most vivid. So once you've layered it with all these exciting sensations, it's very apropos to consume and destroy this piece of artwork very symbolically. So I just remind people, it's all about performance art. And in closing, what we do too is also limited in ways that performance art, traditional art, and food are all limited, right? We need an event, we need an audience, we need a very specific time, and we have a lot of food safety constraints to conform to. But we also have all of the benefits of all three as well. The lasting imagery through photos and posts and hashtags, through the immediate performance art, like a dancer with applause, and then with food art, where people are like, yeah, my belly feels good now. So guys, please, I know it gets hard at times. Oh, if anybody gets that, it's me. But keep making art to eat, all right? Hugs and kisses.
You're so awesome. This is why Heather is my cake wifey. So do you want to just chat for a bit now?
Sure.
because you're right.
That's my rant.
That's
my rant. That's my whole, like, you're going to stand here and listen, then that's what I'm going to make you. If you have an editorial, that's what I'm going to write you, because I feel that message is important for cake artists and that we all remember that. I have to write it down. I have to read it to my clients. And it's just, we're shaping our own businesses, our own art, our own niche in this world. And I know I hear it so many times. People are like, oh, I want to do that stuff, but they want a buttercream sheet cake, you know. I get you. I read you. And it's educating our public is a large part of that. And it's also confidence in ourselves and what we do.
Well, that's why I put that on my cake sale page, which has not yet actually sold a cake, I have to say. But that was part of the point, as I can take that hit, of don't think of me as a baker, which nothing wrong with bakers, but don't think of me as a baker. Think of me as an artist, and you're buying some custom art.
Absolutely. And I think that cake artists should absolutely work in groups where you have a cake artist like me who doesn't. I bake, you know, I understand the chemistry, but that's not, you know, really. I mean, and then you have somebody who does amazing flavor profiles, and they can knock out an 8-inch cake in an afternoon, and everybody's like, oh my gosh, it was so delicious, and it was $100. There is room for everyone along the spectrum, and if you're not comfortable doing a cake, I really think it's important to be able to say, hey, you know what? I have a friend who can really do exactly what you want, so that the customer is satisfied and then, you know, comes back to all of us.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I put one of the options on my page was, I can't afford for you to make me a 5-tier cake. Will you, if I come to you way in advance, will you make me a cake topper that I can buy, you know, an inexpensive grocery store cake? And I'm like, yeah, of course you can do that, because then you're still getting art. There are all so many ways that we can offer our clients options so they can get the art. We get the creativity. They still get a giant cake to eat that maybe doesn't cost $1,000 that they can't afford.
Exactly. There's all shades of the spectrum. And, you know, it's just, there's a room for everybody. There's room for every cake. There's room for every budget. You know, as long as you don't want to go into a Ferrari dealership with a Honda budget and then get upset, you know, that's different. But I mean, as long as you understand that there is value here, that you wouldn't go to your plumber or your lawyer, or your doctor, and ask these professionals to work for less, and that expectation needs to go away for other cake artists, quilt artists, knitters. You want a piece of custom art, you need to pay for it. And I think that in today's society, we have so much stuff that we're starting to like, okay, you know, yeah, maybe I don't need 20 t-shirts. If I have a really nice embellished one that I paid a decent amount for someone to hand make because I admired their work. I think artist following is definitely going to be big in future years.
Yeah, and there's no reason. I mean, I've had cases a lot of, because, you know, I mean, since I don't sell cakes often, sometimes what I've done is I've done effectively bartering. You know, I had a scientist come out to Peo's 7th birthday party, and in exchange I made his kid a cake. That was where the bleeding zombie rat came from.
Oh, nice.
Because this kid wanted, his mom emailed me and says, you know, I know this sounds really weird. And I'm like, yeah, okay, you're already talking to the right person. But do you want, like, he really likes zombies and he really likes rats. And I'm like, you know, I've been experimenting with some blood stuff. Do you want a zombie rat cake? And she's like, you can do that? I'm like, yeah. Do you want me to make it bleed? Because, like, I don't know your family. So, like, am I pushing this too far? And she's like, oh, would you do it? So it gave me the opportunity to experiment.
Yes.
And no, I wasn't being paid.
Right.
But an actual astrophysicist comes to my kid's party and talks about Eris, which nobody was talking about Eris.
Ooh.
Delights my... So, like, he didn't get paid. I didn't get paid. But we both exchanged.
Exchanged value. Absolutely. And I've actually done that as well. If you go on my page, there's a little pig. Little brown pig with a pink crown. And I actually exchanged that for half of a pig because the woman raises heirloom pork, right? Little red pigs. I'm serious. They're like, you know, as long as your arm. And they're cute as all heck, you know. But
you ate it.
Well, yeah, she comes to me and she's like, you know what? It's my 30th birthday and I want a pork princess and I want a little pig and I want a crown. And I'm like, sure. And it was the greatest thing. I filled with hot pink cake.
Oh, that's, see, again, there are reasons why you are my cake wifey.
She loved it. She loved it. And the pork was really good, too. That was some good chops. Yum, yum. Organic farm-raised pork. You don't get no better than that.
Oh, you need to come visit me because, like, I have a bacon man. Have I told you about my bacon man?
I go to this
farm shop, and I know the man who raises the pigs and is, like, all sustainable so I can feel, like, not too horrible about it. And he makes, like, smoky, dark, smoked bacon.
Oh,
like, it flavors your whole lasagna. And we're totally off cake now, but I don't care because everyone listening right now who's, like, in the middle of putting a dragee on, it's like, I want some bacon. And, someone right now is working on a vegan cake going, I need some bacon in my face right now. But yeah, because, and he'll do it to me super thick cut, and I mean quarter inch thick cut,
oh.
Or he'll give it to me uncut and I can make lardons with it, so you have to come to my house.
Oh, you're killing me, Smalls.
maybe we should wrap this up on bacon. Before we're going to go find some bacon here in Austin. We're hungry for lunch now.
BLT. I need a BLT now. Austin, where are your BLTs?
All right. We're going to go get lunch because we apparently have hit the low blood sugar laughing part standing in the Holiday Inn parking lot after the show.
Yeah, we're fine. We're fine. Really, over here. Don't worry about us.
We're just slightly punch drunk after the Austin show. All right. Thank you so much.
Lots of love. Check out Art to Eat and Eat the Evidence.
This has been the Eat the Evidence podcast. A warm thanks to all of my contributors, and you can find out more about them and the things discussed on today's episode in the show notes by visiting the podcast section of the Eat the Evidence website, eat-the-evidence.com/podcast. There, you'll find social media links as well as links to iTunes, Stitcher, and other places where you can subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. I've also posted detailed instructions on how to leave me a Facebook voicemail message and other options to call into the show. Please do feel free at any time to call in your very own cake formation, funny story, talk about a challenge you're having or have recently overcome, or rant about something driving you crazy. And if you like the show, please post a review on iTunes and share it with all of your sugar artist friends. This show was produced and edited by me, Kimberly Chapman. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, you are an amazing artist, and everyone involved with this podcast supports you. You can do it! Until next time, bye-bye, and good luck with whatever you're working on.